Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom.
We have a great show for you today. We're going to start off with an interview with City Councilman and soon-to-be County Supervisor Luis Chavez before talking about some election results. Then we'll have Juliana Morano on to talk about a few stories in the news, and we'll close with what we're loving this week.
All right, today we have another election-themed episode. With us, we have Fresno City Council member and soon-to-be Supervisor Luis Chavez with us. Glad to have you on the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, so Luis, you have been a elected official in Fresno for over a decade, coming into the Fresno Unified School Board in 2012, representing Roosevelt High area, now currently representing Southeast Fresno, and now going to be representing Southeast, Central, Southwest Fresno.
Some parts of North Fresno, a little bit of Clovis.
Such a weird district. Little bit.
Yeah, it is.
I didn't realize you had Clovis in your
district. A little bit of sliver of Clovis out there by the old Pelco buildings.
Oh, in my district. That's interesting.
I heard that they get, for the Rorschach test, they just look at political maps to create their designs.
You would think so. So one of the reasons, many reasons that we wanted to talk to you, Luis, is you've been talking to thousands of voters as you have been in your campaign. So tell us a little bit, how many voters have you talked to?
God, we were going through the data this past week, and I'm a huge data junkie. And earlier I mentioned I knocked on 19,765 doors myself. That's a lot of doors, a lot of people. I don't even know what that equals to in miles, but we did it through the summer. We did it through all four seasons and more. And it was a great conversation, but I think I would say probably about 30% of those doors that we knocked on, we had really great conversations with constituents, and more importantly, turning in things such as potholes, streetlights out, tree trimming, illegal dump sites galore. That was probably one of the most requested services that I turned in for folks in the County Islands and in the city. And keep in mind, this district goes from all the way from American Avenue down there along the 99 freeway to Shields, and then on Shields shoots eastward to First, all the way north to Shaw, all the way to 168. So it's
a big
area.
How many people live in the district?
200 plus thousand.
Wow. So that's almost double the size of Clovis.
Oh, absolutely.
District.
Absolutely. That's just one district. Yeah. And it's the most urban district. It has a lot of the challenges, obviously, but a lot of hardworking people. I think that was my favorite part, just having those conversations with working men and women of that area.
Beyond just the immediate neighborhood issues, what other things came up when you talked to people?
Obviously, the national politics that's going on, right? And I contrast that with the primary, and the primary was like dud turnout 101. I think our turnout was like 19% or something like that.
It was low.
Super low, super low, terrible. And so people weren't really engaged. And at that time, people thought it was just going to be Trump versus Biden. So there wasn't really a lot of energy. But now flip that coin now to the runoff. People were very engaged. Mm-hmm. A lot of issues that came up at the door with regards to what was going on nationally, foreign affairs.
Like, say more about that. What specifically do people in Fresno care about foreign affairs?
I think especially with what's going on in Gaza, mm-hmm. and a lot of the images that are coming out of that place, mm-hmm. are just very horrifying. And I think people were very impressed with that, not in a good way. Mm-hmm. But I would say that was probably one of the most common topics on foreign affairs. And then obviously what is going on around the world with North Korea sending troops to Russia and Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So those topics come up, I think, because of the national context.
Sure.
But for the most part, it was local issues that I think people were more concerned about. Inflation, for mm-hmm. sure. I'll never forget this. There was a gentleman probably in his 70s, and he actually showed me a receipt of how much he was paying for his usual groceries at Walmart, maybe about 3-4 years ago. And then he showed me the exact same order now, and it was like $200+ different, same items. Mm-hmm. And so I think people are really feeling the crunch right now. And I think that's one of the reasons why it translated to Democrats really losing across the country, where we just were never able to communicate, not only feeling the pain, but what's going to be our response on the economic side. So a lot of those conversations, I had them, sometimes comfortable, sometimes uncomfortable, as I knock on Democrat, Republican, Independent doors, Green Party folks. So they all have their various different viewpoints. But I was always happy to answer questions. And sometimes we agreed, sometimes we didn't. But at least they knew that I showed up and listened to their neighborhood concerns.
Did you hear demographic or see demographic differences? There's a national conversation right now happening about Latino men, about white women. And where did you see the changes in the electorate?
I did. I see that. And I'll say this for point of reference. I've ran in every election cycle since 2010, with the exception of 2020. And so I'm very familiar with what you hear at the door and the neighborhoods and the same folks. And I've noticed this shift where I think because of what I described earlier, the anger and the frustration, I think, unfortunately, President Biden and Vice President Harris were the target of that because people wanted somebody to be angry about it. And they are in office, right? It's part of the responsibility that you carry. But I did see that particularly with Latino men, I would say middle-aged Latino men, for whatever reason, I saw a percentage of them gravitating towards Trump.
So you think this is more generational versus a kind of an ethnic swing in that way?
I think it's a combination of both but to your point, I think that age range, I noticed it across the board. Even some of the African-American men too that I knocked on their doors, I was a little bit surprised. Some of them would wear MAGA hats, and it's rare to see that in South Fresno, by the way. So I did pick up on some of that, those undertones that were going on. And I think as Democrats, I think we have to do a much better job of communicating, because there was a lot of great things to communicate. The Build Better Act that President Biden spearheaded, and a lot of the construction projects that people see nowadays happened because of that ARPA funding that we received, health clinics being built. But for whatever reason, our national strategy was just not communicated very well. And there'll be obviously a dissection of what happened. But I think Fresno saw part of that too.
And our senior editor, Rob, was telling me that Fresno has historically been a bellwether for the popular vote. Did you know this?
I did know that. And I was really shocked, because when you look at the map, and obviously they're still counting votes, but I do anticipate Trump winning the Central Valley, the Inland Empire, except for the coastal regions and the large urban centers. I can't remember. I think the last time that a Republican president won Fresno County was like 2004. With George W. Bush. Biden won, Obama won. And so it was like, what's going on?
Right. And what was interesting to me, so many things are, is Bernie won Fresno County in the primary not that long ago. So how do you have a county that is majority Bernie flip to Trump? I think I can see the shift.
I can see the rhetorical elements that are at work there, right? Appealing to working class and in certain ways that crosses that chasm.
Yeah, what's your take on that?
I 100% agree. And it was interesting because I remember at the time when Bernie Sanders came, my district hosted him over at the fairgrounds. And I've never seen that many enthusiastic young people following a older gentleman like that.
It was
from Vermont. He's been old since 2000 too. He's so old.
And it was a little bit, puzzling, but I heard him speak, and I think he did speak to a lot of working men and women. And I think that's what, former President Trump was able to do, to communicate with that working stiff, so to speak, and say, hey, this is what I'm going to do. Whether that happens or not remains to be seen, but at least the conversation was had. And I think we just were not able to do that very well.
I'm curious, in knocking on doors, another thing that's been front and center in this election is immigration issues. Did that come up when you were knocking on doors?
It did, and I see it from the context. So the southern part of the district has a lot of the immigrant community. And when I say immigrant community, I'm not just referring to Mexican immigrants. We have a large Central American population. As you folks know, we have large Punjabi, Asian folks that live in our community. And they all had that perspective, but it was under the umbrella of immigration and what happens if Trump would get into office again, because I think they still remember the images that came out during the first term that President Trump termed under. And so there was a lot of angst. I'll give an example. There are some folks that are under a classification of, I think it's I-360, where they submitted their paperwork. They're still waiting to get approved, but they're worried that's going to go away. And so what do they do, right? We have families that are now potentially going to be broken up. Why? Because the person that applied and had their foot in the door, so to speak, might have to return to their country of origin and then resit as part of what's being potentially proposed. And so I think that uncertainty was definitely on people's minds. And I think, you know, we're going to have to work through that. I think as a city, as a county, as a region, we're different than other places. I mean, we depend on immigrant workforce to keep our economy going. And we literally feed not just the state, but the world. So any disruption of that or rhetoric, I think, affects it. I would not be surprised if this next harvest season we have a shortage of folks that are willing to go out there and work, because I think that angst will keep people away.
How do you see your role going to the Board of Supervisors to stop a lot of deportation from happening?
Well, I think one of the things we worked on at the city, and I'm very proud of that, is I've led the effort to put in the Immigrant Legal Defense Fund, and with the emphasis on keeping families together. Obviously, I would love to see something like that at the county. I do have a very conservative cohort that I will be going into. But here's the interesting part, and you talk to even folks on the other side, Republican, there's obviously the knowledge that the folks that are working out in the fields and the packing houses in every agricultural industry are immigrant folks. Mm-hmm. And so we've seen what that does to our local workforce, our economy. So I think that's the question that my conservative colleagues are going to have to answer. Are you supportive of eliminating 40% of the workforce that we have here, maybe even more in certain industries, just to satisfy political rhetoric that was said, right?
And Trump has said he needs to rely on local law enforcement agencies to carry out this vision. And are they willing to allow sheriff's office to get involved in this?
And that's going to be the big conundrum, so to speak, because right now you see our police department, our sheriff's department struggling to just address the regular community crime, so to speak. We have a jail that's overcrowded due to federal decree that's down here, and
I think that retail proposition just passed, and so then exactly. That's going to create a huge issue.
It is. We're already hearing that, by the way. I had a conversation yesterday with our city attorney and our mayor with even the care courts that are coming down the pipeline, where the county will be responsible for authorizing these committal, so to speak, to the services. So, you know, our sheriffs, our police department, one, will not have the time, energy, or resources to do it, and two, once you start doing that, you create the stigma of law enforcement not being there to help, but rather break families apart. And we've been trying to break away with that perception for the last decade here. So I think that would actually hurt our community and increase crime, because if you don't have people willing to come forward and confide,
call for help if you're worried about that.
Yeah. Absolutely not. I just went through that conversation with the food vendors that we struggled and worked really hard to bring under the umbrella of the city. A lot of them were reluctant because of their immigration status, and now they feel welcome. So now we throw in this dynamic. And I think during the last Trump administration, I was the chair of the COVID subcommittee, and we actually got a request from the Trump administration to provide them with data, i.e. names, information, addresses for people that were receiving services, food distributions, by the way. We refused to turn that over because we didn't feel that was necessary. But there's a reason why they were requesting that. And even the conversation of just having that be a possibility would deter people from coming in and getting a box of free food or a vaccine or PPE. So I think we have to be careful about rhetoric and what that actually does. But I don't foresee that happening here locally. And if it does, I will speak out against it and fight it as much as possible.
Do you feel like when you were talking to voters that there was a dissonance, especially in the Latino community, with their stance on the economy and supporting Trump and his immigration proposals that he's put out?
It was, and it was really interesting to see that. And I'll never forget this. It was over at one of the elementary schools. There was a parent that was wearing a T-shirt, a MAGA T-shirt, and at the same time had an English learner child. And so you scratch your head, and I mean, obviously, people are free to exercise their right and all that. But I mean, it was really confusing to me. It's like that old meme that's going around. It's like, chicken supporting KFC, which is bizarre to see that. But I think that's why the numbers are reflective of what happened in Fresno County and throughout the nation, quite frankly, right? Swing states that went for Trump rather than Vice President Harris, I think, was a big red flag.
Okay, so you're going to now be in this new position, and you will have some control over not necessarily inflation on a mass scale, but certainly you have some levers to pull around housing affordability, energy prices. How are you going to address that? What's your going in day one? What's your path forward?
What's the plan, right? Yeah, I did get that question actually often at the door, especially for the affordability piece. We see rent prices going up. I think the average now is about $1,500 or so.
And you haven't been a supporter of rent control.
I have not. And I don't think that works. And I always give that example of not just other cities that have done it, but even here locally, when you have rent control implemented on mobile homes, and there's a reason why mobile homes have not been built since 1984. You have to have a balance of the private sector coming in and funding that, because government can't do it alone. So interesting you should say that, because the mayor and I just went and had a presentation done at one of the projects in my district over by Fowler and Tulare. And so those are affordable units, 3-bedroom, 2-baths. And the way we're making them work is they're all affordable. Excuse me, about 80% of them are affordable. And I think that's going to be the key for the affordability piece. I really believe that we need to build, and we need to build. That's what brings the price down. And as a matter of fact, I want to release that, but I want to be respectful of the person that built them. They actually quantified for every X amount of units, the price of rent comes down in the market where they have. And I think that's going to be the key for the affordability piece. But energy costs have gone up, right? PG&E bills are 150%, 2%, 200% of what they were doing. We just did a program for senior citizens over at the Village pilot program. We had a wait list of 80 plus seniors that didn't have an AC unit. And we've had one of the hottest years that I can remember. I was at the Fresno Fairground opening ceremony, and it was October, and it was 104 degrees. It's not going to let up. We got to address that. And I think I can bring that perspective to the county, energy and solar, and investing in that.
There was a proposal at the council a few years ago that sort of died to study creating a city utility. Why did that die? And why can't that be a feasible option for there to be public utilities?
I think it is a feasible option. And like with anything, I think it's not going to happen overnight. The staff has already been processing what that model will look like for Fresno and yielding some of the savings. Myself and two of my other colleagues went up to visit the Sonoma Power Exchange. And here's the ironic part. This is the part that was frustrating to me. So the solar farms that were built out on West Fresno County, they actually transfer all of that energy to the Sonoma Power Exchange. So here we are in Fresno County generating megawatts of energy, and it's getting used up north. We need to be capitalizing on that. Now, whether it's a full-on public utility or a hybrid, I think we should definitely be exploring that. The cost, I think, initially was, what do you call it, a sticker shock.
I'm sure the upfront cost is part of the obstacle.
Because you have to build your own infrastructure, is that why?
You do. You have to build your own infrastructure and then the maintenance of it, right? PG&E and other utilities struggling with the maintenance and then the liability of them causing fires and other natural disasters. But I think the hybrid approach would be a good place to start. And
because we wouldn't have the risk of PG&E services the Sierra Nevadas and the foothills that have a higher fire risk. We wouldn't mitigate some of that risk, right?
And right now, we grant a monopoly to PG&E, right? Other states that open it up to other vendors that come in. But I think at some point, we're going to reach a breaking point. I had seniors at the door telling me that sometimes they had to decide on whether they buy their full amount of groceries and then buy their medication or vice versa.
Yeah, there's something that's come up too with county supervisors, this concept of transparency and public participation. How do you think about that? And do you think you and Gary joining is going to change that? Or do you think the culture will be similar in some ways?
I'm not there to just rubber stamp. I think right now, and I'll say this, the pandemic really shaped and affected me as a public official on what our role should be. I saw a lot of vulnerable populations get sick and die because they didn't have access to medical services, because they didn't have access to resources. And I think the budget is a part of that conversation. Regardless of what the board as a cohort wants to do, I'm going to bring that to the residents. So I've already talked to my, you know, soon to be former colleagues. I'm going to be doing joint budget meetings with them in their districts and bring in the county departments, whether it's mental health, social services, veteran support services, and making the public aware. I can't tell you how many times I walked up to the door and people said, what does a supervisor do? They don't know. Mm-hmm. There's such a disengagement and a disconnect. Mm-hmm. They know what a council member does because we're in their neighborhoods picking up trash and water and sewer and all that, but a lot of them don't know. And so I intend to jointly do that with my colleagues now, soon to be former colleagues.
Yeah, I do think important. People picture some smoke-filled room, closed door. That definitely comes to people's minds.
Yeah, they do. I mean, think about this. It's $5.2 billion that the county administers. We have about half of that or so. And the bulk of that is social services, right? But what happens is a lot of people don't understand how to get access to that. And I'll give you a very concrete example. Our home care workers, you know, over 27,000 of them here in Fresno County. Last year, over 600,000 hours, I think, went unused because they don't have the capacity. People don't take advantage of those services, not because they don't want to or need them. They do need them, but oftentimes they don't know how to navigate the system. I think that's been done deliberately to keep the budgets the way they are, but that's not what we should be doing. I think for me, my goal is to create a safety net in at the county where the most vulnerable populations can have somewhere to go. Senior citizen that doesn't have a family member that advocates or pushes for them. The foster kid that gets pushed around different homes, six homes in the last year. And I think we need to shore that up and address that.
So tell us about your transition plans. I saw that Henry Perea Sr. is on your team, former county supervisor, current industrial lobbyist. So what's your first 100 days? Do you have that plan?
So the first thing we want to do is set up a joint meeting with the city and the county. Part of that is the homeless issue. We talked about it during the campaign, 1,000 beds, 100 days. I think that's completely doable. We have the facilities, we have the infrastructure, and we need the funding on both ends. So that's going to be, you know, one of my first projects, but also the social services component. Their social services department is about $454 million a year. And the county has a different budget, and this is part where I think the community needs to be engaged, because it's like that old saying, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. We have a month-long hearing session for our budget where department heads come and present and people come and give their input. And as you've seen through some of their advocacy, we've increased the number of dollars for the eviction protection program or parks or the senior hot meal programs or even building a community center for seniors. And so I think the county needs to also engage in that type of conversation, because I really do see that being part of our job out there.
Your role and reputation on the Fresno City Council member, you're not the firebrand that some of your colleagues are, but you're in a going into a different place where there's been a lot of consensus culture. So how do you see your brand of politicking, if you will, evolve in this new context?
I'm very good at what I do, and I'll give you some examples. I really don't like the politics. I didn't start off in politics. I didn't do an internship with a congressman or a local elected official. I started working off as a teacher and work for health clinics. And so I don't like the politics, but I'm really good at navigating them. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is because I think at heart, I always bring it down to, why do you do what you do? And it's about people. To me, it's always been about people. And one of the things I've been able to do very effectively, I've repaved 22 of the 30 plus neighborhoods in my council district. Before the previous person was there, we maybe did one or two. We built health clinics in that area. We got the first regional park. I can't tell you how hard it was to get the $8.5 million for Southeast Fresno, but we did it. So I think at the end of the day...
How did you do that? I just talked to Jose Barraza about that recently.
Part of being effective is, and I think Ronald Reagan had this old saying, it's amazing what gets accomplished when nobody takes the credit. because you want to give everybody a buy-in on what they did. And but I can tell you that project wasn't going to happen anytime. It was on the bottom of the list, but it was important.
Why was it on the bottom of the list?
Because it needed so much work to mm-hmm. just get it to that point. And by the way, it had a community garden in there, and there's a rail spur that goes right through it that right. we still have to work with the federal government. So there was, I think I counted like 23 reasons why this was like very difficult to do. But it was important. And it was important because that part of the city doesn't have a regional park. Mm-hmm. They don't have green space. So I did what I needed to do behind the scenes, and I got the $8.5 million, and we all celebrate it. But those are the types of things that people can expect from me over at the county. You're right, I don't go on Twitter. I don't fight with people. I don't call people names because I think that's counterproductive to what you want to accomplish. You can't go somewhere and spit in somebody's face and then expect them to support you. That just doesn't work like that. It's great for television, great for talking points, but it's not good for effective governance. And I take that job very seriously. I treat everybody with respect. I don't engage in that type of thing, but there's a time when you need to do business, and you do business. And I'm very effective at that because I think my results speak for themselves. And I think the voters saw that too. It was one of the most wackiest election cycles, and to take out an incumbent on the Board of Supervisors hasn't happened in 28 plus years. There's a reason for that. They're so entrenched. The bureaucracy does what they do. And keep in mind, the county of Fresno literally weaponized their legal department and sued me to keep me from transferring my council dollars over, right? Do as I say, not as I do, when they were doing the same thing. And so this election started off with that, but I think for me, I've always put my trust in the hands of the voters. I think people know me now, and they know my core, and they know who I am. And I shake your hand, I look you in the eye, and what I tell you is what's going to happen. And I think that's why we're able to get labor support early, because I've worked with them, whether it was working on them with the PLA or other agreements that we had, or making sure that they felt like they had somebody that they could work with and making sure that we got things done. But from the beginning, there was four of us in the election, right? And it was a very low turnout primary. And here's how I knew we were going to do really well. After the primary numbers came out, I actually won Southeast Fresno. And I was shocked because Sal has been there for 30 years. I've been there half of that time. But I also won some parts of North Fresno. And that was a bit of a surprise. Those people have never seen my name on the ballot. Didn't know who Luis Chavez, but I showed up. I went to their neighborhoods over by Fresno State, and I knocked on their doors, and I had sometimes uncomfortable conversations with them. I would not say we agreed on everything, but I think they felt they could work with me. So you look at the numbers for the primary, and I think everybody carved out their own little area. And I think my approach to things is why I think I was like the three little bears, like not too hot, not too cold, like right there. But then after that, I built a broad coalition, and I had EJ support, met with him. Things are very important to him. He's probably one of the most dedicated public servants that I've met locally. And then even my colleague and friend Miguel, right? Him and I don't agree on everything, but we're probably, I don't know, 80, 90% of the time we do agree on things. We work on joint things.
On today's episode, we're going to go through some of the election results from our contest on Tuesday. We're going to start with the Fresno County Board of Supervisors. What happened in those races, Donnie?
It has been anti-incumbency. So we have Gary Bredefeld with a pretty significant lead. He has not quite yet declared victory as of Friday afternoon over incumbent Steve Brandau. That's to represent District 2. And then we have Fresno City Council member Luis Chavez, who has also a pretty significant lead over incumbent Sal Quintero. And we'll see if both of those leads hold next week.
And incumbents usually retain their seats in Fresno County. That's
they
the
usually
norm.
Do. It's we were looking at this at Fresnoland, and I think Rob found that the last time that an incumbent was taken out was when Judy Case joined the Fresno County Board of Supervisors about 2 decades ago.
Okay, I was busy watching Nickelodeon. All right, next one, Fresno City Council District 6. This one's incredibly close.
This
what do we know?
So close. So they are separated by
259 votes.
Woo! So that is a really tight margin. Nick Richardson is a Marine Reserve officer. He has the lead over personal injury attorney Roger Banokhtar. This one was a surprise race for many people. Roger had all the endorsements. He had the establishment lined up around him, and he's not winning.
What's the sign of Nick's success? What's he doing? What's he tapping into, do you think?
I've been talking to a lot of people, as have other folks on our team, and what we're hearing is a couple of things. One, he has been walking the district quite a bit, talking to a lot more voters.
Knocking on doors.
Makes a difference, as it turns out, because he had way less money. I think he was out fundraised like 10 to 1.
All right. So continue on. Fresno Unified had a number of trustees up for election this year. What are the results of those races? There's three of them, correct?
Yes. There are contests in the Roosevelt High School area, in the Fresno High area, and the Hoover High area. The most competitive of those races still going into today is the Hoover High race between incumbent Claudia Cáceres, who's been on the board since 2016, and then challenger Dan Bordona, who picked up the endorsement of the Fresno Teachers Association.
And that's the one we're most likely to see an upset, correct?
Currently, he is leading. So yes, it's very possible, although it remains a very tight race. Let me do the math. I think they're separated by just 200 A little over 200 votes.
Yeah, 210 right now. Votes is what it looks like.
Another race that's not necessarily close, but that also saw the Fresno Teachers Association backing a challenger and sinking a lot of money into that campaign was in the Fresno High area. However, incumbent Andy Levine was taking on two challengers, James Martinez, who is a FTA-backed candidate, and then Emma Villa. They split support between the two of them. So Andy Levine right now has over 4,000 votes, or about 44%, to James's 100 votes to Emma's 2,500. Andy is definitely leading by a significant margin that would be hard to overcome.
And James was backed by the Fresno Teachers Association.
Yes.
Okay. All right. What about Central Unified? We had one race there.
Yeah, we were following the challenge of incumbent Richard Solis by newcomer Jaspreet Sidhu, who is a nurse, and he won pretty heavily.
Yeah, this is
70%.
Yeah, that looks like the biggest margin that I see in these trustees' votes, right?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
What do you attribute that to?
He had a lot of support from Punjabi Sikh leaders, and Central Unified is a growing Punjabi Sikh community in West Central Fresno. So I think he had the community connections, and that made a lot of a difference.
Okay, let's jump to Clovis Unified. We've got a close race in Area 2. Molly DeFrank and Wilma Hashimoto are almost neck and neck.
They are. Yeah, there's just, less than 100 votes that separate the two at this point. And that race has gotten closer as the subsequent ballot counts have come out. Molly DeFrank, her husband, I believe, was on the Clovis Unified board, so she would be replacing him. Mm-hmm. Wilma Hashimoto is an educator, and we'll see how that one plays out.
Okay, and then there's one more race, Area 4.
Hugh Autry is the incumbent. He has incumbency bias, I guess, if you can call it that. And Gina Vu is another educator challenging him and does not look like she's going to win with just 38.3% at this point.
All right. And then, Donnie, do you want to go through some of the local measures? What's interesting to point out about them?
Yeah. So in Clovis residents had Measure Y. It was a 1% sales tax. Clovis is now going to be one of the highest tax cities in Fresno County should this pass.
They should put it on their banner.
They really should. This is a general tax going to the general fund in Clovis, although it's been marketed as a public safety tax. Technically, they can't force the city to spend the money on public safety if they don't want to. Anyways, it looks like it's passed. And in Madera County, we have Measure T, another sales tax that is, it's not a tax increase because the county residents already pay into Measure T. It's just extending it. Anyways, I'm not entirely sure if that one's going to get through. It's currently at 51.9%.
Very close, yeah.
What does it need to pass?
It needs 50 to pass. And the late votes are really, we'll see how those pan out. The late votes just generally, this is conventional wisdom across the board, tend to skew Democratic. And Democrats generally liked taxes more than Republicans do, but there's been progressive groups in Madera County that are opposed to Measure T. So I'm not entirely sure how this is going to play out in the next week.
Okay, and then we've got a couple school measures.
The bonds, yeah, this has been a good cycle for most schools to have a bond on the ballot. Fresno Unified's looks like it's passing at 61.6%. Central Unified's also looks like it's going to sail through at almost 62%. Clovis will probably eke it out. They're at 55.47%. They need 55% to pass. It's interesting because Clovis Unified's bond was the only one that got basically everyone to support it. They got even the most anti-tax group imaginable, the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, to endorse it. They got Bryson DeChambeau, like the professional golfer, to endorse it.
Wow.
Yeah, it was stunning, and yet it's almost failing. So wow. Not really sure what to make of that.
Comparatively, the Fresno Unified bond saw opposition from the school board's president, Susan Wittrup, and her boyfriend, Darius Assemi's PAC, also came out against this bond. And yet I think that one is the one most comfortably passing right now out of the three school bonds.
Yeah, it's right up there with Central. And I forgot to mention, we also added Sierra Unified up in the foothills too, and their bond is passing at almost 66% support. There is one bond measure that right now looks like it may not get through, and it's the State Center Community College District bond, measure Q, and that one's only at 53.57%. All right, so today we have Juliana Morano, Fresno Land Labor and Economy Reporter, here to talk about two stories this week, because as it turns out, it wasn't all election coverage. So you covered a proposed ordinance that got discussed at Fresno City Council this past week on mobile food vendors. What was going on and why was there some tension around this?
Yeah, so this ordinance, some of the most vocal opponents would say that it came very abruptly and felt fast-tracked. And it is true that in September, that was when vendors in the city, specifically sidewalk vendors, so this isn't about food trucks, it's about people with like carts and things like that in the city.
The Elotero man.
Yes.
Things or like, woman.
Yes, got a first draft of this ordinance that the city of Fresno was considering. It was sponsored by council members Miguel Arias and Luis Chavez, as well as council president Annalisa Perea. That I can talk about more, but was part of the surprise, because those two, Arias and Chavez, are some of the most frequent supporters of mobile food vendor causes, at least that we even saw a week ago with the investment they brought for Cultiva La Salud's commercial kitchen for mobile food vendors. However, so in September, mobile food vendors found out about a first draft of this ordinance that basically threw new restrictions on where sidewalk vendors could set up, including around residential areas relative to highway on-ramps, off-ramps. They said would basically ban eloteros and make Fresno a very anti-vendor city and impose so many restrictions that there were very few places where they could go. After speaking with some of the council members sponsoring it, they argued that really this wasn't an abrupt thing. They pointed to last summer a pilot program that was rolled out in the Tower District that was rolling out a specific set of regulations for vendors in that neighborhood, where council members say there have been issues with, particularly along like Olive and where some of these sidewalk vendors set up because of this kind of concentrated nightlife in the Tower District, where they say vendors were disposing of their grease in an unsafe way for the public and getting into disputes with each other in terms of where to set up for like prime real estate and things. So yeah, they say that kind of laid the groundwork for a new ordinance, so it wasn't like as abrupt as some people said. But at the same time, at the council meeting on Thursday, when the council was supposed to take their first vote on this ordinance, they received so much public comment from vendors, some of whom were brought to tears talking about how this would affect them, that ultimately the council kind of at the prompting of, I believe, Tyler Maxwell, pushed back this ordinance because it seemed as though there was this need to pause on this decision that could really impact this segment of Fresno's economy, which is largely Spanish-speaking and consisting of immigrants, which was something else that came up too in some of my conversations with advocates, that mobile food vendors in Fresno who, in the last several years, especially following the murder of a street vendor named Lorenzo Perez, who was killed while vending, in the wake of that, the city promised all these investments and protections to improve their safety and so on. And in the wake of that, the Mobile Food Vendor Association formed this more organized body of people to convey their feedback and demands with the city. Mm-hmm. But it's not like that association has decades of negotiating with the city and so on. It's like this kind of group
that had to
scramble to negotiate with council members who they're
who
had just been like supporting them on some things and then seemed to be cracking down on them abruptly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is what the council gets when they create an organized association. They organize.
Yes.
We'll see how that one goes. So another story I want to talk to you about is a story we've talked about on Fresnolandia before, and it's the proposal from a gated community east of Fresno in Clovis to de-annex from Sierra Unified and to join Clovis Unified. And there was a final decision about that this week that you reported on. So what did the special Fresno County Education Committee have to say about it?
Yes. So the county committee, in a meeting that lasted less than an hour, voted to smack down this proposal, this petition.
And it was a smackdown. What were the things that they said?
There was some chastising. And of course, it was written in a very legally consulted way, so it wasn't scolding Granville Homes or any of its staff by name. And
I do find it tasty when you get a smackdown legally. So that's a personal preference of mine. Yeah. Not everyone's into that, I guess.
I'm happy to read.
Yes. Give us something here. Let's go.
What does a smackdown in legalese sound like? Ooh,
lots of passive voice.
Yes.
First of all, the committee voted not to approve this petition. They also took separate votes on 9 criteria required under Ed Code in order to even consider using their discretion to approve a territory transfer. They voted that only 2 of those 9 criteria were met. The rest, they failed. So in terms of what the statement said, and they weren't obligated to issue that statement. That was a choice by the committee to do. And they voted to approve this in the form of a press release. They said that every dollar and every hour spent reviewing a non-meritorious proposal is another one that's diverted from students in the classroom. And this is
I can feel the vitriol. Yeah.
And another brief quote. Therefore, the committee encourages the submission of only those proposals that can clearly demonstrate compelling local educational needs and meet the minimum education code requirements. The law does not permit territory transfers based on convenience, individual preferences, or the benefit of real estate developer interests.
That's as clear as it can be, right? Setting the precedent of gerrymandering school districts for real estate benefits is just going to be a terrible thing for the region, obviously.
That would have been, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just to add, the developer in question in this story is Granville Homes. And this was one of several attempts made by staff that staff were involved in to try to gather or absorb territory from Sierra Unified and add it to Clovis Unified. And there are also, records of them and their affiliates talking about improved marketability for homes if they're in Clovis Unified. So this was all well established through public records, their past involvement and current involvement in this petition.
And there's a lot of undeveloped land. So this is, for those listening, this area where the petition originated is Ventana Hills, which is part of the Millerton Newtown area by the Table Mountain Casino. There's a lot of subdivisions, gated communities out there. And there's still a lot of undeveloped land, a lot of it owned by Granville Homes. So I wonder if the pause on the ending of this quest to join Clovis Unified will stifle that development.
Yeah, we're going to have a Tony Hale running around these neighborhoods. Certain...
You said it, not me. That I appreciate Arrested Development references wherever I can find them. Thank you.
we're going to close today with our favorite segment, which is what we're loving this week. And I'm going to start this week. I am loving layering. The weather changes. I love stacking sweaters and jackets. And
really?
Yes, I love layers. I love multiple layers.
I mean, I love it too. I'm just, I don't know why I'm questioning you right now.
No, I know. It sounds like I'm being facetious, but truly, I love layers. And I love just looking through my closet and finding what I can stack. Like I'm a Lego thing. Like I'm a Lego in some ways.
For months, I've been waiting to add turtlenecks back into the mix.
See, Donnie? Yes, layering is where it's at. Juliana, what are you loving this week?
What am I loving this week? Oh, I started The Wire.
Ooh.
So.
Is this a first watch?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
And Rob, my editor, watched The Wire, too, so it's just so fun to quote it with him.
Where are you at? Character... Season one still? Season two. Okay. What was your season one experience? Give it to us.
And it's... I know that in college I watched season one, but I didn't know what a clearance rate was in college. I feel like working at Fresnoland makes a lot of shows that are about cities and stuff way more interesting to me. I think I always love shows that are like in some ways about a workplace and just the problems you experience in any industry. And I don't know, I just see... And like the things that we cover too, mm-hmm. like it's giving me windows into the police department is a workplace the mm-hmm. same way that any place is. And yeah.
You feeling the itch to work in a basement somewhere on some case.
If it was worthwhile.
Yeah. You never know.
All right, Donnie, what are you loving this week?
Can it be something I'm loving if it hasn't happened yet, but it's going to happen?
Yes, you're loving the anticipation of something. So what is the anticipation for?
I'm going to Yosemite this weekend. I'm very excited. Have you been to Yosemite in the fall?
No. It's my favorite time to go. Yes, absolutely.
So you need to go, Juliana. I'm glad you know what I'm talking
about. Driving down the
roads
while the leaves fall is glorious, and I think everyone should experience it. Absolutely. And it's also quieter in the fall. You don't have the same kind of
the crowds are not
tourist
there.
Churn with it. But yeah, it's just beautiful. There's lots of people there doing like photos.
You know,
with the foliage. Photos with the foliage.
I mean, can you blame them?
Are you bringing a camera?
No.
Oh, okay. Bringing a photographer?
No.
Okay. You're just going for...
This originated because last year, people who know me know I am a fall, what's the fallophile?
Fallophile?
Is that autumn a thing? File? Is that a word?
Girl, go whatever way you want.
We've talked about this, Juliana. Fallophile. Like, you and I love fall. We've
We'll do fallophile. Go ahead.
Yeah. And last year, getting some seasonal depression and texted like a random group of friends that didn't know each other and just said, I think I was influenced by a picture of Yosemite in the fall on Instagram. And so I just said, who wants to go to Yosemite with me and my family tomorrow? Everyone responded. And so
you have a caravan of people going.
So there were three of us families that went. The other two didn't know each other. So it was like their first introduction. And it just was this most serendipitous thing. And I listened to Taylor Swift Red because that is the fall album of the Taylor Swift albums. So you have to.
Yeah. And I think just going to the hotel, I don't know what the name is.
No, exactly. So we went to the Iwani. We got cocktails.
Sit on that back porch.
You sit on the back porch. Your kids go play in the woods. You have your, you know, fall cocktail. It's perfect.
Yes.
I don't even think I hiked at all.
It's not necessary.
It's really
you're there for different reasons. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.